it's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Would you like 2023 to be tax-free? Hey, it's Lars. Then make plans to join David Moore for a free webinar Wednesday, March 29th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time for the latest 1031 exchange news and updates. For those asking for the nitty-gritty of a 1031 exchange, this is your class to learn the basics of the 1031 exchange, what qualifies, and how to apply the process. In this webinar, you'll learn the lingo, a glossary of terms, what you should know about doing an exchange in 2023, the benefits and pitfalls, and flipping with a 1031 exchange. If you're an Oregon broker, this 1031 exchange class provides attendees with 1 hour of core real estate continuing education and the knowledge to identify and apply the 1031 exchange to client investment real estate transactions. Plus, anybody who signs up gets a copy of the slides and a link to view the session again. For more information and registration, go to 1031exchange.com. You've worked hard to earn your money. Equity Advantage works hard to keep it yours. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, where we endeavor to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Now, I want to start with a question. I want to ask you something, and I don't want you to take offense at the question I'm asking you. But I know that many of you are parents, and this has to do, I think, most of the time, where you might find the objection with your daughter. Would you object if the school your daughter goes to, and we're talking K-12 schools, not universities, would you object if the school district said, by the way, your daughter is going on a field trip? Maybe it's an athletics field trip. Maybe it's a speech field trip, because we did lots and lots of those when I was in high school. We'd go to another town, and sometimes we'd be in that other city for 2 days and two nights. And that meant that we had to sleep in a hotel. Would you object if your daughter ends up sleeping in the same hotel room with a so-called trans girl, meaning a biological boy who identifies as a girl? Would you object if your daughter said, by the way, Dad, I'll be sleeping with Susie, except that Susie's actually still a boy? Now, I'm going to tell you the school district that is doing this. And I want to tell you something about when I get a tip like this, and I did, and I appreciate the tips, because the tip was not just, hey, Lars, this is happening. Can you imagine the reaction of parents if they knew this was happening? But the person also set the document that the Salem Kaiser schools were using to outline, and I'm going to read it to you in a moment, the one paragraph that says, we will send some biological boys to sleep in the same living arrangements as biological girls, except the biological boy identifies as a trans girl. Are you, as a parent, no matter how liberal you are, let's say you voted for Obama both times, you voted for Joe Biden, you plan to vote for him again, and if Joe's not available, you're going to vote for Kamala Harris. That kind of liberal as you are, would you be okay with the school district, which, when they are in charge of your child, they are what the Latins would have, in Latin it would have been in loco parentis, meaning they are there in place of the parent? And would you have an objection if the school said, yep, your daughter's going on a field trip, we'll be housing her with other girls, including a trans girl who is still actually a biological boy? Now, I have a granddaughter. She's 7. I talk about her from time to time. If she goes on field trips, she will not be sleeping in the same room as a boy, even if the boy identifies as a girl. And maybe you find it politically inconvenient to say that's how you feel, but I want to know what you think about this, and I'm glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's where we start. Of course, we're going to get to the border problems we've got, to the federal government's problem with figuring out the debt ceiling, and whether or not they are going to full-on, for the first time, actually default on the debt. 4 other times, there's been a technical default on the debt, but never have we come this close to the U.S. government actually defaulting on its debt payments. And if we do, I know there are estimates of how badly it is going to hit everybody in this country. I don't know if the estimates are over the top, under the top, or just about right. It is not going to be a pretty sight if the U.S. Congress and Joe Biden cannot get together on a solution to this debt ceiling problem. And right now, the stick in the mud turns out to be Joe Biden. Even though as a senator, he talked endlessly about how you have to negotiate these things when it comes to the debt ceiling, right now, he's saying, I'm not budging. You want to increase my debt ceiling, you increase it. I'm not giving up anything, meaning he will not commit to any reduction in federal spending, the same kind of federal spending that over America's history has put this country in now $32 trillion in debt. And Joe wants to spend another couple of trillion dollars, and he doesn't want to say that he's willing to cut any spending right now. He says, give me the increase first. We'll talk about cuts later on. But first, welcome to the program. If you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here on the Radio Northwest Network every single weekday. It's 866-HEY-LARS. That's and if you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And, of course, you can answer our Twitter poll. I got a little bit of a cold sneaking up on me. Is spending more and more money on the homeless only making the problem worse? As you know, both Seattle and the Puget Sound and Portland and Multnomah County are literally spending hundreds of millions of dollars every year. Over the course of the next decade, the two metro areas may spend as much as $5 billion on the homeless problem. And here's the problem I see. They have spent more and more money over and over and over again. And the more money they spend, the worse the problem gets. Case in point. The Taxpayers Association of Oregon points out that in Multnomah County, the number of unsheltered homeless has increased by 21% in the last year. And they say this is despite the metro regional government's two brand new income taxes that were expected to bring in about $200 million a year. You know, 20% of $1 billion to spend in a year. And yet the more money they spend, the worse the problem gets. So I would vote it makes the problem worse. Multnomah County takes credit for reducing the number of chronic homeless by 16%. But last year, they handed out about 22,000 tents to encourage people to sleep on the streets and stay out of the shelters. So in other words, all you got to do to reduce the number of people living in shelters is say, go ahead, pitch a tent somewhere. Here's the tent, and you can go ahead and use public property. But let me get back to what Salem Kaiser Schools are doing. And by the way, if you feel as outraged at this as I do, I suggest you call Salem Kaiser Schools. I'll give you the number in a moment. But first, let me tell you what is going on. I got a tip from somebody on the inside. And he said, Lars, take a look at this field trip policy. It goes on for about half a dozen pages. But he said, look at page number 5 and look at the highlighted paragraph. And here's what it says. And this is what parents are going to have to deal with. And I want to know whether or not parents are signing off on this nonsense. Quote, in sleeping arrangements segregated by gender, transgender students, that means boys who identify as girls or girls who identify as boys, are allowed to room with the gender group or the individuals they choose, with consideration for gender affirmation and student safety. A gender-neutral sleeping option will be made available. The decision for each accommodation is not the school district's choice. It is the student's choice. Number one, I think this puts young ladies in particular in a hostile environment. And assault is a possibility. But even if the child is not assaulted by the identifying as girl, transgender girl, who's actually a boy, can you imagine how uncomfortable it would be for most young ladies at 15 or 16 to share a hotel room on an out-of-town field trip? It ignores the duty the school has to protect the children. And I've called Salem Kaiser Schools hours ago. They haven't even responded with a call back. So if you're not happy about that, call them up. 503-399-3000. That's 503-399-3000. Vote in our Twitter poll. And we'll have the Northwest Nonsense coming up next on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
You know, if you want a proof, the proof that you ask for from time to time of the tax greediness of governments here in the Northwest, look no further than a case that is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. Oregon voluntarily signed on to the case. They didn't have to, but they wrote what's called an amicus brief, which means friend of the court that supports the dark side, the bad guy's side. Now, let me tell you what it involves. It involves a 94-year-old woman in Hennepin County, Minnesota, who fell $15,000 behind in her property taxes. Now, I've talked about the case more than a few times over the last year as it worked its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. You see, Hennepin County finally took back the woman's home. It was a condominium, and they sold it for $40,000 to pay off the $15,000 debt, but that's where it changes. They said, we've paid off your debt, we sold your home, we're going to take the other $25,000 that they were not owed and keep the money. Now, I think ripping off old ladies sounds pretty sleazy to me. And yet, Oregon's Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum has filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court supporting the idea of ripping people off. Yes, the same AG Rosenblum who decided not to charge her Democrat Party friends with a felony for accepting $500,000 that was stolen in the FTX cryptocurrency scam. They took it under a false name. That is a felony. Even liberal Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan seemed kind of shocked when she heard the argument before the Supreme Court. Her quote, are there any limits? I mean, what about a $5,000 debt on a $5 million house? Take the house and don't give back the rest? No, when it comes to taxes, the greed of Democrat governments know no bounds. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Better Basements and Waterproofing. Water in your crawl space or basement? Call Better Basements and Waterproofing.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill on all of those who've contributed to the problem of illegal drugs in the Northwest. That is Washington Supreme Court, Oregon's voters who legalized hard drugs, and then what did the police report over the last 2 days in the Portland area? 8 overdose deaths and fentanyl is suspected. So Joe Biden gets a piece of this problem too, because the fentanyl for the most part comes from China through Mexico across a wide open border that Joe Biden contributed to. And in fact, I think largely created. And then it comes into your communities. 8 people dead in 2 years, and the Portland Police Narcotics and Organized Crime Unit say it appears that users believed they were ingesting cocaine, but it was really a blend of cocaine and fentanyl, or possibly even pure fentanyl powder, and they ended up dead. Their deaths are on the hands of everybody who has contributed to this problem. Our best email so far, but you can always send more, to talk@LarsLarson.com. Teresa D. writes in, Lars, I keep hearing people ask the question, what has China received in return for the money given to Joe Biden and his family? I think the answer is right in front of us every day. Seems to me that Biden is ensuring the United States is committed to the Green New Deal policies, and therefore we're going to be fully dependent on China for everything for us to survive. It all has to do with the necessary thing we call energy. I don't know if any solar panels are made in America. Some of them are, as a matter of fact, but not very many. But they are for sure made in China. Plus, they're the ones who are mining the materials that go into all those batteries. So Biden is making good on giving something back to China by ensuring our dependence on them, signed Teresa D. Now, I'd like to bring on the show Hans Urshinger Davis, who joins me now. Mr. Urshinger Davis, thanks for coming on. Would you mind telling my audience what the Lighthouse Mission does in the Bellingham area?
So Lighthouse Mission Ministries engages the homeless issue in our community in 3 different ways. Through our outreach, that's on the street, engaging people with a shower trailer, a van, giving out basic needs, getting them into our base camp facility, which is a 200-person easy access shelter, to our recovery programs, and then on to our restoration programs, which is getting people back to work, getting their kids back from CPS, getting them back into society.
And some of that money to support that mission came from Whatcom County, correct?
Actually, no. We are totally privately funded in all of our operations. However, the county did reach out to us because they're building a new facility to double our impact. We currently reach half the population of Whatcom. We want to reach the whole all Whatcom people that experience homelessness in a year. And the county said, hey, we could help you pay for your new kitchen because we're building a new facility. He said, that would be wonderful. Let's do that. And no strings attached. I mean, we're a Christian organization, so we can't take any government funds that will, you know, make it so we can't share the message of Jesus. And they said, no, there's no conflict. You can do this. Please apply. And so we said, all right. And so we did. And that's when the county council said that they don't want to work with organizations that have religious hiring bias.
Because when you go to hire somebody, and I guess there was one person in particular, you said, we're not going to hire you for a Christian mission if your lifestyle and your beliefs don't match up with that mission, correct?
Yeah, no one has actually applied or anything that doesn't align with our values or our faith tenets. But there was a hypothetical that was thrown out there by one of the county council members, and I had explained to her that these folks have to sign off on a statement of faith, which includes submission to the Bible, and if they can't do that, then they can't work for us. And so she assumed they wouldn't hire her friend.
Okay, so on the basis of that, have they completely cut you off from any of that new funding?
They have. I can't work with you at all. This is federal funding, and our hiring practices are perfectly legal. It's in the Constitution. they said that we're not going to work with you because you hire only Christians to work for you.
Is it fair to say, now I'm not a lawyer and I'm guessing you're not either, but is it fair to say Whatcom County has now discriminated against your organization specifically because of your faith beliefs?
I'm not a lawyer either, but that's exactly how it feels to me.
And that feels to me like a violation of the First Amendment, because government isn't supposed to say, we're going to give you money unless you're Christian or unless you have Christian beliefs, and therefore we're not going to give you money. That would cross that bright First Amendment line, wouldn't it?
It would. And so it's pretty discouraging because we've actually done a lot of work with them in the past. We operate an isolation and quarantine facility with them. We've worked doing different shelters with them when it was a high priority during the pandemic, and now that we're building a new facility, they've chosen not to work with us anymore, which also to me feels like bad governance. I mean, the mission here in town is the biggest game in town when it comes to homelessness. We engage half the homeless population every day, 365 days a year, and for them to say, we don't want to give you this money that's slated for that purpose to build you a kitchen, that doesn't make sense to me.
No, it doesn't make sense to me either. That's Hans Erschinger Davis with the Lighthouse Mission. We'll put out a call to Whatcom County, too. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. And you, of course, are invited to be in the conversation as well. If you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, why, we put you right to the head of the line. We get some good naysayers. Sometimes we get some bad naysayers. It's always interesting. But you know that catalytic converter theft in the Pacific Northwest has been a gigantic problem. And there may be a reason why both Oregon and Washington, despite brand new laws passed by both legislatures, prove to you that most legislatures don't have any idea how to actually solve a problem. In fact, we've actually seen thefts go up after the so-called legislative solution is put into place. So I thought we'd talk to Carrie Sharon, who is a consumer advocate and analyst, about this problem. Carrie, welcome to the program. How are you?
Hey, Lars. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about this. You've got a brand new study up, and the title of it, sorry, I'm working through a cold, Catalytic Converter Theft Hits a New Record for 2022, but some states are actually seeing a drop in those numbers. Describe the picture for us, both in the Pacific Northwest and around the rest of the country.
Yeah, catalytic converter theft is one of those crimes that we're continuing to see grow year over year, particularly since the beginning of the pandemic, as thieves were really after those precious metals. And a lot of states, you know, in the past couple of years have taken action to curb it via legislation, but a lot of it is really just targeted towards the auto recyclers themselves, not necessarily the thieves, the people actually doing the crime and affecting car owners, right? And yeah, in the last 3 years, Washington and Oregon being two of the hardest hit states across the U.S. In 3 years, Washington's catalytic converter theft percentage is up nearly 8,000% from 2019. And Oregon is close to 4,000% increase. Idaho, a little bit, lesser of a growth rate, but as we see some minor, may I say, declines in Washington and Oregon, Idaho is now seeing that uptick.
Is there a pattern to all of this that would indicate what works and what doesn't to stop it, whether you're stopping the recycling companies that are buying the illicitly obtained catalytic converters or stopping the thieves? What works?
Yeah, I think, the real thing to go after is the behavior that is, causing the crime. And not a lot of states are actually, creating legislation in that fashion. They are going more so after the auto recyclers. But what we do know is that not all stolen catalytic converters go to, U.S. auto recycler. A lot of them are shipped overseas so that those precious metals can actually be harvested and then resold, which is kind of what spurs the theft in the first place.
I mean, is there any detection at that level? I take it if you're saying sending it overseas, you're not putting it in a UPS or a FedEx box. You're probably loading up a cargo container and then bringing it down to the local port saying, this one's going to Korea or this one's going to some other place, if that were Vietnam. That's how they ship them out. So you'd think a good place to intercept that kind of activity and identify who's behind it might be down at the ports if they're really shipping those kind of quantities. But is that being done?
I haven't seen any legislation in the last couple of years that specifically targeted exports of catalytic converters. Obviously, I'm sure it's happening kind of under the radar, and that's certainly something to consider. Pennsylvania is one of the states kind of, they were an early adopter of laws kind of to prevent this crime, and this is really before it even took off at the beginning of the pandemic. One of their laws actually prevents catalytic converter sales across state lines, so they're trying to prevent it from even leaving the state. But again, thieves will be thieves, right?
Well,
so if it's going to go out of state, it's probably going to go overseas.
And how do you even know it's going out of state? Because I assume most of these operate without any kind of benefit of paperwork. So a bunch of thieves that I know were identified in the Northwest more than a year ago, they were actually loading up trucks and then just driving them to New Jersey, offloading the product to people who I think had good reason to know that it was illicit, that these were stolen catalytic converters, but then they probably didn't care about it. So if you load up a truck and drive 2,000 or 3,000 catalytic converters that may be worth hundreds of dollars each, it's well worth your while to hire a truck and hire a driver of your own, one who knows the gig, and then drive it. How would you even find out that was happening?
Yeah, so I guess it would be, kind of similar to other state laws that would really be rolled up to a federal, coverage, which doesn't exist for catalytic converters at the moment. A lot of laws change when a state border is crossed, whether it's, kidnapping, the transportation of, drugs or other type of illegal substances, things like that. The second you cross a state line, that immediately becomes, a federal offense or a felony. It's covered under federal protection or federal law. Right now in the federal Senate, they haven't even really taken up any bills that have been proposed to cover this crime. So if you're going to go after the crossing the state borders, states really would need to team up, right, and have task forces kind of involved to find, identify potential trends and, transportation methods for stolen catalytic converters. Because, right, they're not going to have a big van driving down the highway that says stolen catalytic converters.
you think? I'm talking to Kerry Sharon, who's a consumer advocate and analyst. But this means that even without new legislation, I mean, if the FBI or the DOJ said, we have people, say they load up 3,000 stolen converters onto a box truck, doesn't have to be in a long haul truck, and they're driving it across state lines, that's, say, a couple of $100 each. If you figure that's the stolen value of it, that's $600,000 in that truck. The minute you take $600,000 worth of stolen goods across a state border, wouldn't that draw the interest of the FBI or the DOJ?
You would really think so. which is why I think they need that, you know, legislation to, you know, move forward on any operations in that regard so that we can see better coverage for consumers nationwide. But right now that doesn't exist. So I think you're on the right page, but how can we support them kind of getting there and making that case? And in addition to the $600,000 stolen goods, you know, in relation to the cost that's actually hitting consumers' pockets, that's chump yep. change, because that's like $2,000 to $3,000 per converter out of pocket for any given car owner if they don't have, you know, comprehensive coverage to cover their vehicle.
Yeah, and in fact, when you see those kind of numbers, is there any sign that any of the laws passed at the state level are having any kind of effect on this problem?
So it does look like Washington and Oregon see very minor increases, but again, still up significantly from 2019. Idaho now kind of taking the hit for the PNW and, you know, seeing bigger gains in the 2021-2022 time period than Washington and Oregon. Now, that's an overall percentage, while volume is still much, much higher in both Washington and Oregon, with thousands of thefts occurring each year in 2021 and 2022 in both of those states, while, you know, it's a little bit lesser of a crime in Idaho. So Idaho, you know, has a new legislation which is very similar to the Oregon and Washington legislation coming out that will take effect July 1st of this year. So that'll be something to maybe keep an eye on. But again, it's targeting the auto recyclers, you know, making sure that they have the paperwork, the identification of who they bought it from, and all of that. But how do we prevent the crime from happening in the first place? Because it's the consumer that is really, you know, taking the biggest hit, the biggest loss.
I think you're right. That's Carrie Sharon from who's a consumer advocate and analyst. The new money or the new information is coming from Ben Verified, a public data company. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. And what we do every day, at least every weekday, we don't work weekends, is try to make sure that we provide honestly provocative talk to the Pacific Northwest. Now, your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And I get some great emails, like Heidi. Heidi heard me talking at the top of the hour. And what I talked about is the Salem Kaiser schools, and I can virtually guarantee you that all the other school districts in the Northwest have similar policies. And here's what Salem Kaiser has said. And by the way, I called them about 5 hours ago. They have not even bothered to give me a courtesy phone call back, because what I wanted them to explain is, do you expect that parents will embrace the idea that when kids are going on high school field trips? Now, some field trips are for the day. When I was in high school, I swam in junior high, but I did mostly speech and debate in high school. And that meant a lot of trips out of town. We'd go quite a distance away for various speech tournaments. We'd go to Washington State. We'd go to the state of Oregon. We'd go to university campuses. Sometimes we were so far away that we had to spend the night. Sometimes we'd end up spending two nights. Now, the question is, who is your daughter or your son going to share a room with? And I would say it's not sexist to say the bigger concern might be those of you with actual biological daughters. So your biological daughter is going to go on an athletics field trip. They're going to go on a speech or debate field trip or any kind of field trip out of town. Now, who are they going to spend the night with? And who are they going to share the hotel room with? Well, the answer is that they're going to share the hotel room with people of the same gender, because all of the school districts will say boys will go in one set of hotel rooms, girls will go in the other. The problem is the transgender discrimination that is happening right now against conventional children, for lack of a better term, says your daughter may be spending the night in a hotel room, perhaps even sharing the same bed, we don't know, with a biological boy who identifies as a girl. Now, I put that out there. I read to you the district's policy. And what the policy says is that, you know, the trans student is in charge of the process. In sleeping arrangements segregated by gender,
transgender students are allowed to room with the gender group they choose, with consideration for gender affirmation. So all of this is being done to benefit and to allow the decision-making to be made by the transgender student. And what happens? What happens, let's say, when your daughter says, look, I don't want to share the room with a biological boy. I don't care if the biological boy identifies as a girl. I don't want to share the room. Now, we know from the last couple of years that when conventional people, people who actually identify as the gender they were born with, I know the transgender community hates it when we draw this out and say, look, you are outside the norm. You're an outlier to the norm. When your daughter says, I don't want to spend the night in a hotel room with a boy, even if the boy says he identifies as a girl, the school district is going to say all of those arrangements are at the discretion of the transgender person, meaning the biological boy who insists that he's actually a girl. Well, I got this email from Heidi, who writes in, Lars, as a former corporate EEO, that's Equal Opportunity Employment, Equal Employment Opportunity Manager, I can tell you these children forced to sleep with biological males can also sue for same-sex harassment. Just because a male student identifies as female does not preclude him from being accused of same-sex harassment or a claim being filed against him or her. I'm surprised more students don't recognize these EEO cases and file a same-sex harassment claim. I think that's very possible. And imagine what a legal nightmare this is going to make for the school districts. And yet the school districts are inviting this. I mean, for example, We understand that teenage boys and girls will get together and sometimes be involved with each other sexually. But the school is not there to facilitate that hookup. All right? And if they did, I mean, let's say a school district said, why, there's this young man and his girlfriend is going on this speech trip, so we're going to let the two of them share a room together. You'd say, well, that's outrageous. You can't have those two. I mean, they may do all kinds of things back at home, on their own time, in their parents' house, in a car, wherever. But the school is not supposed to be facilitating this. And yet, it seems the school is going to do exactly that. They're going to facilitate this, except you would never put a biological boy and a biological girl in the same room unless they're trans. And that suggests a second level of discrimination. It says, if you're, say, going on a field trip and you have a girlfriend who's also going on the field trip and you say, would you mind if we roomed together? We're that close. The school district would say, no, we're not going to do that. That wouldn't be right. But if you say, I'm a transgender boy, meaning a transgender person who is biologically a boy, but I identify as a girl, then you can sleep with them in the same room. Now, I don't think this is right. I think it is discriminatory. I think it violates the students' rights. And you can only imagine what's going to happen the first time a school district gets sued for allowing this kind of arrangement, or parents get angry enough to say, at the next time you bring up a levy, I'm voting no. And I wouldn't blame parents one little bit. Glad to be with you. Glad to take your calls. 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday, and as you know, anytime it gets hot, as it has over the last several days in the Pacific Northwest, what we hear immediately is the climate change folks say, why, these are new records. They're being broken, and it's all because of SUVs and coal-fired electric plants and all that. I think that's a bunch of hogwash, and we've told you why. But I thought I'd bring on our friend Chuck Weiss, the meteorologist and airline pilot, who's with us today. He has taken the point of view over his career that when you look at the science, it does not back up what the wackadoos like Al Gore and the rest of the climate change movement have talked about. So, Chuck, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here, Lars.
And tell me about go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking to myself, you and I did media things a long time ago. You go back a long time in Portland media, and I haven't been on the air doing anything like television weather in many, many years. But when I was doing it back in the 70s, and when you were doing television news, this warm weather that we experienced over the weekend wouldn't have been thought of as anything more than just a nice, beautiful, warm Mother's Day weekend. And the focus would have been to show people outdoors and enjoying themselves. And no more narrative brought to it than that. And instead, the focus, as you were pointing out, goes towards, oh, these temperature records are just unbelievable. Scorching heat. I mean, the headlines are just nauseating. And they're just not honest. And so I did some checking into this because I saw a report from the Multnomah County Health Officer, Ann Loeffler, that was featured on many of the TV news stations, saying that because we're warming so fast in May, the human body doesn't have time to acclimate to this. And under certain conditions, that would be true if you're going from a winter to a tropical summer-type climate. But the air mass was so dry over the weekend that affected our region, evaporation is a key to controlling the temperature of the human body. And she completely ignored that and said these 90-degree temperatures could be excessive. Well, they're not. And if anybody was out on this, you wouldn't have felt that sort of heat of 90 degrees. You feel something cooler because the dew point, the wet bulb, and the wet bulb globe temperatures all indicated that there was significant evaporation with a very low relative humidity. And this controls the body temperature and makes the outdoors actually feel quite comfortable. I was outside in this weekend, and it was beautiful. I mean, how could you say it was anything else? And instead, all the hype is on, oh, this hot weather, breaking records. Well, if you go talk about the records, they are not climatologically significant. And the only thing they point to by getting into the low 90s and breaking some of the daily records is when you compare them to the last time it happened, it just shows that this sort of weather in May is infrequent, which it is. There's nothing trend-wise in the climate records that would say, oh, well, things are getting hotter. It's just getting awful. And there isn't anything there to support that. And in fact, if you go back to May 28, 1983, we've actually hit 100 degrees in Portland. So there's nothing unusual about this stuff, and yet it's hyped like there's no tomorrow. It's just nauseating. There's no truth anymore.
And for example, when I looked at it, and I wanted to reach out to you both about what the county health department was saying, that this is hard for people to adjust to, but I also looked at this number. The last time on that date, on Saturday, so Saturday just passed, that it hit near to that point, it was a 92 degrees, and it was a record, but it was set in 1973. 50 years ago, it hit that number. And you say, well, that was before Al Gore started all of his climate nonsense. In fact, in 73, if I remember right, all the scientists that anybody listened to were saying we're headed for another ice age at that point. And so we've been that hot before. And then you've got people trying to build the case. This is unusual. It is unique. It is a sign of things that are changing. And as you point out, the numbers don't support it.
They don't support it at all. And I just saw a headline this morning. This was on USA Today. Scientists warn an El Nino is likely coming that could bring scorching heat to the Earth. Horror of horrors. We're all going to die. I mean, these sorts of headlines are nothing more than fake, stupid journalist sensationalism. There's nothing more true to it than that. And yet they're putting them out now as we approach summer because they want people to believe that climate change is causing this serious threat to our health and safety and lives when it's doing no such thing in the records. And as I pointed out on the show before, atmospheric science sorted all this stuff out years ago, and all the climate people today haven't done a thing to prove the founding work was ever wrong, which basically says CO2 cannot control Earth temperature. They've done nothing to disprove that except invent these failed climate models, which cannot predict the future climate. And we know why, because of the limitations of them. And so the hype switches from what it used to be. They used to say that, well, a weather event like this weekend is no proof of climate change. And they stuck with that until the global temperatures quit cooperating with them. And now they've reversed that. And now they're going back to saying, well, these individual weather events now are proof of climate change, be it storms or hurricanes, tornadoes. They just keep throwing this nonsense at us, and there's absolutely no truth to it. And it just eggs on the politicians to do these crazy things that they're doing that you've already talked about on your show, such as restricting natural gas. Now they want to control how much hot water you can use in your dishwasher. This stuff is just crazy and irresponsible. But it's being egged on by this sort of thing.
Sure, because Chuck, to your point, if you didn't look at just one date in May, if you said, look, in May's gone by 50 years ago, we'd have 390 degrees in a May. And now, and then in the 80s, we had 4. And in the 90s, we had 5. And you would show some kind of pattern, wouldn't you?
You absolutely would. And right now, if you take a look at that, there's nothing that points at any change in the trend of the number of days that this is happening in over the long term. Now, what they do to some degree to cheat on this is they only look at 10 years' worth of records, and then they ignore everything else. This happened when they were talking about the 80-degree temperatures in April. They said, oh, you know, you take a look at the last decade, the number of 80-degree days in April has been going up. Well, I look back for 100 years of records and coupled the Vancouver-Washington record into the Portland one because it's a viable substitute for the time before 1940 that Portland no longer reported temperatures. And what I found was we had the same number of 80-degree temperatures in June, or not in June, but in April, as we are getting now. And so there's no discernible trend in the data at all when you look at enough of the record going that far back. But you can cheat by taking the higher low points and making those your starting position to say that the number is going up. If you started this trend in your data of 1970 and brought it up to now, then you'd look at this and say, oh, gee, the climate's getting warmer. But if you include the 100 years of record, there is no trend. And that's the right way to look at it. You can't throw out data that you don't want to look at. And that's how this climate facade continues today. It's complete nonsense. It's a lie. I'm getting sick of it personally because I just see that the politicians are destroying our lives now with this nonsense. And as they try to do all these stupid things with electric vehicles and restricting natural gas and everything else, we're not going to get a thing for this. You're not going to control atmospheric CO2. You're not going to change the climate whatsoever. It's a complete facade, and it's hurting us. We got to stop
it. It's going to cost literally trillions of dollars, and it'll lock in decisions decades from now that we can't easily undo. That's Chuck Weiss, our friend, the meteorologist and airline pilot and global warming debunker. In a moment, I want to talk about Joe Biden. He says everything at the border is going just as he planned it. We'll talk about that next.
How do you think things are going at the border, sir?
Much better than you all expected.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. That, of course, is Joe Biden, who stopped in the middle of a bicycle ride. This time he didn't actually fall off his bicycle as he has before. But a reporter was asking, what do you think about the way things are going at the U.S.-Mexico border? And his answer was, better than all of you expected. In other words, things are going very, very well in Joe Biden's view. Of course, he was down at the beach. He didn't bother to go to the border. Neither did his vice president, who, as I told you last week, she decided to go off to a Democrat Party soiree in Georgia to raise money for Democrats running for re-election. But from Joe Biden's point of view, what's going on at the border, not that bad. It's much better than all of you expected. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, what I want to do is illustrate for you just how bad our situation is. At one point last week, we were watching as many as
10,300 people enter the United States illegally every single day. The final number for all of last week was about 83,000. Now, I know that some of these numbers can kind of blend together. Oh, by the way, if you want to vote in our Twitter poll, find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. So when you have all these numbers, 10,300 per day, 80,000 in a week, 300,000 or 400,000 in a month, that we have now had 25 months under Joe Biden in which the monthly crossings of illegal aliens have been north of 150,000. All those numbers, I understand, can seem to blur together. Well, let me take you back. I want you to listen to a guy by the name of Jay Johnson. Jay Johnson and I would not agree on much. I've never been able to talk to the guy, but he was the Secretary of Homeland Security under Barack Obama. And he was interviewed on one of the network news programs while he was Homeland Security Secretary. And he was asked about the numbers crossing the border. And just consider that some days of last week, America saw more than 10,000 illegal aliens come across in a single day. And then listen to Jay Johnson speaking on a network news program in 2019. Take a listen to this.
My staff will tell you if it was under 1,000 apprehensions the day before, that was a relatively good number. And if it was above 1,000, it was a relatively bad number, and I was going to be in a bad mood the whole day. On Tuesday, there were 4,000 apprehensions. I know that 1,000 overwhelms the system. I cannot begin to imagine what 4,000 a day looks like. So we are truly in a crisis.
Now, 4,000 a day. 4,000 a day says we're truly in a crisis, except now we're not at 4,000 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8. We're at more than 10,000 per day. And yet, Secretary Mayorkas, who is the current Homeland Security Secretary under Joe Biden, he was practically bragging last week. Look how much better we've made the situation. Play that soundbite, please.
So we have seen, I think, approximately 6,300 on Friday and about 4,200 yesterday by the United States Border Patrol. And we saw over 10,000 before the end of Title 42 earlier last week.
So all of this comes because of context. If you assume that if you bring it down from 6,000 to 4,000, hey, things are looking great. That's what Mayorkas is telling you. That is what Joe Biden is telling you. So when somebody stops him on his bike, I want to play the whole soundbite. When Joe Biden stopped for a moment, he doesn't answer questions from reporters very often at all. And they say to him, how's it looking? Take a listen to the question and his whole answer.
Okay. How do you think things are going at the border, sir?
Much better than you all expected.
Do you have any plans to visit the border?
No, I think. Pardon me?
Do you have any plans to visit the border?
Not in the near term, no. No, just be disruptive, not anything else.
Now, he says, not in the near future. About the same answer that you got from Kamala Harris, the vice president, who was made the border czar in March 2 years ago and could barely bring herself to actually visit anywhere near the border. So you've got a president who's paying no attention to the problem and simply saying everything's going fine. You got Kamala Harris, the so-called border czar, who doesn't want to go anywhere near the border. And the second part of Joe Biden's answer that I want you to notice, he says, oh, I don't want to go down by the border because it would merely be disruptive. It'd be disruptive for a president of the United States with a country that is very much in crisis with more than 10,000 in some days of last week and 150,000 that or more that have crossed every single month for the last 25 months. You do the math on that. Assume that most months are 30 days long. That means we've been averaging above 5,000 border crossings per day for more than 2 years now. And Joe Biden says, oh, it's going better than all of you expect. Let me give you a couple of other things to think about. Last week, 83,000 illegal border crossings that the government knows of. And even the CBP, the Customs and Border Protection people, will tell you, we don't catch them all. We have gotaways where they got away from us before we could get to them. And even CBP understands that there are people who come to the border. They manage to get across. They paid the coyote extra money. And as a result, they're never even seen by the Border Patrol. They're not just gotaways. They're never see-ems or no-see-ems. So in any case, Title 42, which was a federal law, Donald Trump didn't invent it. It was written by the U.S. Congress long before Donald Trump ran for office. And yet that Title 42 was used effectively to bring American illegal alien entry to the country to one of the lowest numbers that Americans had ever seen. Joe Biden has now taken it to stratospheric highs. And as a result, people are piling up at the border. I want to remind you of something else we told you last week. The folks at some of the activist groups that have gone down to the border, and they're trying to get a picture of what's going on. And what they've found is that U.S. Border Patrol is now coordinating with Mexican authorities on the other side of the border. And why? Because if people come across in just huge groups of thousands of people, it looks bad because network news goes down and shoots pictures of it. And the Biden administration doesn't really care about illegal entry to the country. What they care about is, does it look bad on the evening news? So what U.S. Border Patrol has been doing is coordinating with the Mexicans. Okay, send us 300. We'll process those. When we let you know that those are done, you can send the next group of 300. In other words, they're coordinating things. And what they got over the weekend was a little bit of a drop in the numbers. Now, are the numbers dropping because people have actually received the message from Joe Biden, don't come to the country illegally? I don't believe so. I believe what's happening instead is those who want to push masses of illegal aliens across the border have said, we need to bring the numbers down for a few days so Joe can look good to the evening news. And all the mainstream media can say, look, under Joe, the numbers are coming down. Number one, they're only coming down from 10,000 to 6,000 or 4,000, which Jay Johnson, Obama's Homeland Security guy, said was a crisis. And to Joe Biden, it's just the happy news he's reporting now. Glad to have you with me. I'll get to your calls in just a moment. And coming up, should the poor people be put to death like more than a quarter of Canadians actually believe? We'll get to that next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to talk about whether or not if we get to a majority of people, as Canada is already at a minority, a sizable minority, about 27% of Canadians strongly agree that euthanasia is acceptable for the suffering caused by poverty. And 28% strongly or moderately agree that killing by doctors is acceptable for suffering caused by the homeless. Wesley Smith joins me now, who's an author and a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wesley, does this one bring to mind that essay by, I think it was John, wasn't it John Donne who wrote A Modest Proposal? And that we're really kind of going down that road, aren't we? Welcome back, by the way.
Thanks for having me on again, Lars. Always good to talk with you. I think with this, this isn't satire, unfortunately.
And that
as
was.
I recall John Donne, the satire was about eating the poor. But this isn't satire. Canada legalized euthanasia in about 2015. And since then, it has been it's jumped off the euthanasia cliff, if you will, to continually expand who is eligible. And I think when you do that as a society, and the society comes to a consensus that killing is an acceptable answer to suffering, at that point, the suffering that justifies killing just begins to expand and expand. And what's really alarming, and I've got some other stats here for you from this polling, is Canada is our closest cultural cousin.
Yep.
You know, I used to talk about in the Netherlands, they actually can join euthanasia with organ harvesting and even of people with mental illnesses. And the advocates for assisted suicide would say, oh, well, that's the Netherlands. That's nothing like America. Well, Canada's a lot like America. And by the way, Canada also conjoins euthanasia with organ harvesting. But listen to these stats. As you said, 27% either strongly or moderately agree that poverty is grounds for euthanasia. That's a lethal jab. 28% strongly or moderately agree homelessness. 51% inability to find medical treatment. So the answer, you can't get good care, so the answer is for the doctors who aren't caring for you to kill you. 43% for mental illness.
And by the way, Wes, let me throw into that. And this has been quite a few years, but there was a woman. We talked to her on the show. She's died now. But at the time, she had cancer, and she needed treatment. And the treatment was moderately expensive, and it would only buy her another 2 years of life. But hey, 2 years of life? How about 2 minutes? And the state, which had control of the medical plan she was on, it was Medicaid, said, well, we're not going to spend the $6,000 to keep you alive for another couple of years, but we invite you to contact us about getting the pills to commit doctor-assisted suicide. And that literally happened. We've got a copy of the letter. I've talked to the woman. It was ugly, but it basically said, you're too expensive to keep alive, but we'll spend a couple of $100 to help you kill yourself. So this is an idea.
Yeah, that was in Oregon.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, that was in Oregon. I wrote about that case quite a bit. And because of there was some stink about that, so some of the rationing in the Medicaid program of Oregon was shifted. But you're absolutely right. She received a letter from an administrator of the Medicaid law in Oregon saying, well, we won't pay for your continued treatment for, I think it was breast cancer, but we will pay for your assisted suicide. And you see that also happening all the time in Oregon, where they call it medical assistance in dying, MAID. They always have euphemisms. It's a lethal jab. And 50% say that euthanasia should be available for people with disabilities, which it is, by the way, now in Canada. So, and by the way, next year, mental illness will be eligible for euthanasia in Canada. So once a society opens this door, it doesn't just stay where, you know, the advocates say, well, we're going to have strict guidelines that will protect against abuse. It's just for the few who can't do it when nothing else can be done to alleviate suffering. That's a lie. It's never been true. And in this country, while we haven't certainly gone as far yet as Canada, if we continue to legalize assisted suicide, the grounds for killing will continually expand. And it already is happening in our states, Hawaii, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, have expanded eligibility. Vermont now says you don't have to be a resident, and they permit assisted suicide by telemedicine so that the doctor who prescribes lethally may never even meet the patient. So you can see that there's a cultural imperialism going on here and a desire to spread this death agenda entirely across the United States.
I'm talking to Wesley Smith. He's a writer and a great writer. We've been, as he said, he's been on the show for decades, but he's with the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. I assume it wasn't the Discovery Center that did the poll. Did the people who do the poll ask those questions because those are policies they seem to want to actually push?
From what I can see, I've read the polling, but from what I can see, they did some polling about are the people of Canada satisfied with the way things are now, and majorities were. And then they were talking in the poll to see what attitudes would be to expand what's currently permitted. And that's where they got into the issue of poverty and homelessness. And by the way, there have already been euthanasia cases documented where the person who asked to be killed said, you know, if I could get better housing, I wouldn't want to die. Well, they were euthanized anyway. Or if I could get independent living services, I wouldn't want to die. You've had the veterans, social service people, the VA, what we would call the VA in the United States. I don't know what it's called in Canada. But veterans with PTSD denied services and offered euthanasia. So this is what happens when killing becomes the acceptable answer. Pretty soon that becomes, and it's a lot cheaper and it's a lot easier in the sense of there's not a lot of time and effort that goes into it. And if you think that killing is not wrong, that becomes the slouch to go-to remedy when things get tough.
Although I suspect that the same people who back this stuff, killing because you're homeless, killing because you got mental illness that can't be addressed, killing because you can't get good medical care, are the same people who oppose killing, say, serial killers under capital punishment. And by the way, just I know I'm going to get a lot of email. It was Jonathan Swift, not John Dunn. A modest right. proposal for preventing the children of poor people from being a burden to their parents or country and from making them beneficial to the public, commonly referred to as a modest proposal, where he proposed to ease poverty among the Irish by having them sell their newborn babies as food. And it was a satire, as you point out, Wesley, but that was satire. This stuff is real. What do we need to do to stop this? And the people behind it who apparently believe, well, if you're crazy, we'll kill you. Because I still remember there was a guy in the 40s in Germany who did the same kind of thing with disabled people.
When it's society, yeah, but that was the doctors doing it. He didn't require anybody to do that. And that was a result of the eugenics movement that led to the euthanasia killing of people with disabilities. In fact, the doctors in Germany called it a healing treatment. They thought they were alleviating suffering. And early in that thing, Jewish people were not allowed to participate because they were considered Untermensch, as you know. But what happens is when a society legalizes something, that is the same thing as saying this is right, this is good. And a lot of people take their morality now from whether something is legal or not. Obviously, you and I understand that if something is legal, doesn't make it moral and doesn't make it right.
Nope.
But when you legalize killing in these specific circumstances, it's not surprising that people get the message that suffering is the worst thing possible, so bad that even killing is justified to alleviate it.
No, it doesn't make any sense at all. Wesley Smith writes for the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wes, you know it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
I always appreciate it, Lars. Thank you.
Glad to do it. Now, I'd love to take a naysayer who says, yep, homeless people, just kill them. Crazy people, kill them. Disabled people, kill them. Can't solve your medical problem, just take your own life. If you believe in that, I'd be glad to take your naysayer call. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Oregon Utility Notification Center wants to remind you that whether you're planting a tree, building a fence, or just making improvements around your farm or home, click or call before you start your work to get the area marked. Then dig safely and avoid contact with buried utilities. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones. Know what's below. Call before you dig. For more information, visit us online at digsafelyoregon.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and we proudly serve the Pacific Northwest states over a network of 24 radio stations in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. I want to ask you this. One of the great things about the United States, in which it beats all the other countries on planet Earth, I mean, there are lots and lots of those examples, but one is that by having 50 states and leaving to the 50 states most of the government, you get a chance to let some states do colossally stupid things, and then other states can say, yeah, we're not going to go that direction, because we've already tried that experiment in places like Portland and Seattle, and we saw how it worked out, so we're not going that way. So I want to ask Mark Harmsworth about one of the latest crazy ideas to come out of Seattle, and that is late fee caps. Now, Mark, welcome to the program, by the way.
Thanks for having me on, Lars. It's always a pleasure.
Mark is the director of the Small Business Center at Washington Policy. So, Mark, I've actually had conversations with people I know, including people I work for, and I say, hey, what's the penalty if you pay your rent late? And they said 10%. And you have a few days, like that's due the 5th or the 8th or whatever. But if you don't get the rent paid by then, there's a late fee. And the late fee is 10%. And since most rents these days are in the, $16,000 to $3,000 range, a 10% fee is a pretty substantial fee. But it means you pay the rent on time, because if you don't, there's a big penalty. What is Seattle proposing?
Well, Seattle, in their infinite wisdom, has decided that 10% is just too much. And they've decided that $10 is a more appropriate level for a fine, which is utterly crazy.
It is crazy. And what I'm wondering is, since you're with the Small Business Center, what do you think that's going to do to rents in the city of Seattle?
Well, so if you're in a situation where you're financially, you're just making it, and maybe you're a few dollars short, rent used to be, or should be, the first thing you think about. I mean, it's your home, it's the roof over your head. And so you don't want to be late, because, one, it's not right to be late on it anyway, but secondly, there's the deterrence of the fine of the 10%. And so you know that if you go too long, in some cases these rents are one bedroom in my neck of the woods now goes for around $2,000 a month. So you could be looking at a $200 late fee for not paying it. And so you make a choice between maybe your credit card and paying your rent. Now you're looking at it going, well, there's no deterrent anymore, so I'll just pay the $10 and I'm good. But the folks that are passing this, the Shawans down in Seattle, what they're forgetting is a lot of the homes, the majority of home rentals are owned by individuals, not by corporations. It's their first home. They were able to rent it out. They were able maybe to buy a second home that they're living in. They still have to make the mortgage payment. And so when that rent doesn't show up, they're paying a darn sight more money than $10 in late fees and in interest on their mortgages. And it puts a huge amount of pressure on these property owners who are going to turn around and say, you know what, it's not worth the risk anymore. We'll just liquidate our rental properties. We're going to pull out of Seattle. We'll go somewhere where it's friendlier. And suddenly the rental market becomes even more constricted, which drives up rents even further.
And by the way, Mark, I mean, because what you're talking about is, say somebody owns a 10-unit apartment complex, a small one, and if the rent is $2,000, but let's say their mortgages and other costs are, say, $1,500, $1,600, $1,700 of that, so they're making a bit of cash on top of their costs. If three people are late on the rent and the costs are $1,500, that means you got to front $4,000 or $5,000 to pay the bills without the money coming in from the tenant. That's a huge penalty to the landlord, which might cause the landlord to say that I'm jacking up the rent, because that's one place I can recover those extra costs, you know, without selling out. If they say don't have the option of selling out, and some of them may not have the option, they may say, if we just bought this a few years ago and we have to sell it now, we have almost no equity. We'll be lucky to escape with our skin.
Right, and you're absolutely right. So normally when you're figuring out how much your rental property is going to cost, you have to assume that some part of the year is going to be empty because you're changing renters. So you assume maybe 10 months of rent per year is what you're going to get out of the property. But suddenly you're looking at maybe 1, 2, 3, and like you said, if you had a little duplex or a quad, suddenly you're looking at a considerable amount of money. So what you're now going to do is you're going to jack the rent up, maybe to bring it down to, I'm assuming, 8 months of the year I'm only going to get rent. Suddenly your $2,000 rent just went up 20% or whatever the number is. And so now you're looking at $2,400 bucks a month for rental costs just because the property owner can't assume the risk that you're not going to pay on time.
And by the way, can I make one other comparison, Mark? If you get a speeding ticket or a parking ticket or any of those in cities like Portland and Seattle, I think a Portland parking ticket, I haven't paid one in a while, is north of 50 bucks. And in Seattle, I just looked this up, late fees for a parking ticket are $25. And, you know, if so say the parking ticket itself is 50 bucks or 55 bucks, and you say, but if you're late, we're going to charge you almost a 50% late fee. Apparently, the city of Seattle thinks that's okay. The late fee for traffic tickets is $52. So how is it, what kind of hypocrisy is there that the city of Seattle says landlords who are dealing in thousands of dollars for rent are only allowed to charge 10 bucks, but if you're late on your parking ticket that comes to the city, it's going to be 25 extra dollars, and on a traffic ticket, it's $50. It seems like rank hypocrisy to me.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And then when Councilmember Swan says that late fees can suck you into a debt vortex, I mean, the city's effectively doing that with all these fees and fines anyway. They just don't like drivers, whereas, you know, because they're collecting that money directly, whereas, you know, the property owner's not able to recoup his losses on a bad renter. And they're cutting their nose off to spite their face. It seems ridiculous to me that they would do this, because if I don't own property in Seattle, thankfully, but if
nor
I did,
I
would be looking to get out of Seattle now.
Yeah, and like you said, then in come the bigger companies, which are just going to do the math, and they're going to say, what's it going to cost us to recover this? And they'll end up charging through rent the money they can't get from the late renter. That means that burden hits every single renter, including the people who pay like clockwork on time every month, which doesn't seem very equitable either.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen, Lars.
So what's the solution? Is there one?
Yeah, we need to expand. We want to reduce the cost of housing in Washington State. We need to expand the Growth Management Act. That's the government-mandated thing that forces us to build the way we do today so we can build up some more homes. And pretty much within the next 2 years, you would start seeing prices come down on those and increase the rental market. Plus, Seattle just immediately can start repealing some of this stuff to make it a much more friendly environment to rent properties in Seattle. That's the way to do it. It's not rocket science.
I would add to that, release the urban growth boundaries, allow more land to come in. That drops the price of land. And maybe, say, you want a lot of new housing? Let's forgive all system development charges and other fees for anybody who starts construction of new housing, let's say in the next 18 months. And the government will squeal like a stuck pig and say, but you're hurting us. Well, guess what? Your policies are hurting the citizens, and I care more about the citizens being hurt than the government. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Legal Defense Fund of Marine veteran Daniel Penny has raised more than $1.5 million in donations.
He is raising lots of dough, Penny the hero. Support for him, folks, want to show Penny the hero. No one believes Fat Alvin has a real case. Selective prosecution's a big disgrace. It just cost $2 million. Defense fund is growing. The New York DA's obvious bias is showing. Daniel Penny's a hero. It's so clear to see. They should drop the charges and set him free.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. That's our great guy, Jim Gossett, our parody guy, talking about Daniel Penny, retired United States Marine Corps. And I want you to pay close attention to this story. And if you don't, I still will. This is the man who on the 1st of May, so just 2 weeks ago, was riding a subway train in New York City. And a man on that train that we now know had a long, long list of criminal offenses, assaults, and the kind of behavior that would make you very concerned about whether or not he's a danger. And I want to talk about that aspect of it as well, because there are plenty of people who've been emailing me and say, Lars, the people on that train could not have known about the criminal record of Jordan Neely. They're absolutely right. Nobody could have known. But what they did know is that Jordan Neely, 30 years old, a homeless guy who liked to dress up like Michael Jackson and perform in the subway, had a long history. In fact, he was out on an active warrant at the time that he got involved in threatening his fellow passengers on that subway train. The warrant was because he punched an older lady who was a grandma in the face, broke her nose, and broke her suborbital bone, the bone that's under one of your eyes. There's one on each side. He breaks her face. And that's the kind of charge that he was out on at the time he encountered all these people on the train. And he also told the people, remember, when you're on a subway train, you're trapped. There is no way off. There's no, hey, driver, stop here. I'll get out in the middle of the subway tunnel. He said he didn't mind going to jail or getting life in prison and that he was ready to die. Those are quotes from the now late Jordan Neely. So what happened? Daniel Penny, 24 years old, a Marine veteran who stood up and did what a lot of people would not do, decided to defend his fellow passengers, tried to get the man to stop. Guess what? He is now charged with negligent homicide. And what's happened since then, over this last weekend, as you heard in the song, $1.5 million raised for Daniel Penny's defense fund. Now, I think that's perfectly appropriate because these days we've got a collision, a perfect storm that's happening right now. Police who've been defunded, that's problem one. Prosecutors who are declining to prosecute, unless, of course, it's a white man who is a retired U.S. Marine Corps veteran. In that case, people like Alvin Bragg. This is the prosecutor in New York City. the one who's going after Donald Trump, the one who seems to want to let real criminals go and then go after people like Daniel Penny, which is why he brought charges against Daniel Penny. I have no doubt that he's probably going to be acquitted, just as Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted, because in Kenosha, Wisconsin, he defended his own life. He did so appropriately, and the jury decided that was the case. That's why more than $1.5 million has already flowed in to defend Daniel Penny. But what we've got is an out-of-control system around the entire population, at least in the larger cities of America. You've got citizens who know that when criminals attack them, there is unlikely to be a cop nearby. And if there is a cop nearby, he or she will be operating under rules of engagement that say, we can't do much about the problem that you're facing with this thug. So, and then even if they do arrest the person, like Jordan Neely, the man who ended up dead, they frequently don't do much of anything to contain his problem. He's a guy who had been creating problems for people, mostly in New York City, for a long, long time. And the system just kept ignoring him because, of course, Jordan Neely is a black man. And I'm telling you that because my rule when I was a reporter was that I only put in personal information about somebody in a story if it seemed relevant to the story. And I usually had to make the case, why is it important that this was a woman instead of a man? Why is it important that this is somebody who's black instead of white or vice versa? Why is it important that the person in the case, whether it was the assailant or the victim, is an older person or a younger person? Why is that important? And how could the people on the subway have known about this guy's criminal record? They didn't know about his criminal record. That's not the part that's relevant. What is relevant is when Daniel Penny, the retired Marine, stood up to confront Jordan Neely, it was because he thought Jordan Neely was a danger, and his fellow passengers thought he was a danger. And in fact, that's why two other subway riders joined him in trying to restrain Jordan Neely. Now you say, well, they could have been wrong. It turns out they weren't wrong. All they knew was this guy looks like a threat. Now, why is it relevant to know about his background that the subway passengers could not have known about? Because if you went to, if I tried to tell you why there was this guy and he was acting crazy and he was acting threatening and I perceived him as a danger, a jury has to believe that you had good reason to do that. And all you had was the man's behavior. But when you hear about his background, that he's got a rap sheet as long as your arm, that he had just punched an old lady in the face and broke her nose and broke one of the bones in her face, you say, well, then we understand this was not unusual behavior for Jordan Neely. This was standard operating procedure for Jordan Neely. And now you've got political activists on both sides to some extent. You've got people in New York City who are literally trying to shut down subway trains because they're angry that the man was restrained. And in restraining him, he ended up dying. He died because he was put in a chokehold. Whether it was a chokehold or a sleeper hold is probably up for debate. But the fact is, sometimes when you restrain a person, depending on how you restrain them, you end up causing their death. It happens to police. I've certainly covered stories like that. It happens when a civilian does it, as in this case, in Daniel Penny's case. But this could end up becoming an emblematic case for all of America, even places where there are no subways, like where I live, because people will look at it and say, when there are people in our society who are allowed to act in a threatening manner, and the police won't act, and the prosecutors won't act, and the judges won't act, and the prisons and the jails will not contain them, and the people elected to high office who are protected by men and women with guns say, we're not going to protect you, the public, and oh, by the way, we're not going to let you protect yourselves, Americans are going to come unglued. Glad to get your calls, 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, I've told you that I think the Biden administration has been playing games with the numbers at the U.S. border. Now, of course, Joe Biden is the one who, immediately upon taking office almost 2.5 years ago, took a number of specific actions designed to open wide our southern border. Now, you can agree or disagree with that. Fact is, he immediately took actions that would cause the border to seem open. And of course, he'd spent the better part of a year in his campaign promising that if he became president of the United States, apparently either legitimately or through subterfuge, I believe in the latter rather than the former, that he would immediately welcome in all these illegal aliens. So now we've had record levels of illegal crossings. And then mysteriously, Border Patrol agents have seen a 50% drop in the number of illegals crossing the border since the immigration policy Title 42 expired at midnight on Thursday of last week. I thought we'd ask Julie Kirshner, who's executive director of the FAIR group, where we do FAIR events. We've gone back to the Feet to the Fire event, Washington, D.C. for years. It's the Federation for American Immigration Reform. Julie, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to do it. Tell me this. When I see the Biden administration's agency, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, say, hey, we've seen the number of, they call them migrants, I call them illegal aliens, which I think is more precise. It's actually dropped after Title 42 went away. And over the weekend, Joe Biden was stopped by a reporter who said, what do you think of what's going on the border? He said, it's not nearly as bad as a lot of you expected. Should we believe these numbers?
No, not yet. I think there's a big shell game going on here. And they're not really being truthful about what's going on. So the numbers they're reporting are really only Border Patrol numbers. And if you don't mind me getting geeky with your audience a little bit here.
No, please do, Julie. Please do. My audience would tell you I get geeky every day and twice on Sunday.
That's great. Well, so, you know, the Border Patrol, their jurisdiction is between the ports of entry. So, you know, their ports of entry, official ports of entry, where all the cars go and you line up and you have documents and you show them and they do all the customs work and they do all that sort of stuff. And, you know, typically, not always, but typically, you know, that's really the core for legal immigration. And there's some illegal, but usually it's mostly legal. And then it's between the ports of entry, you know, out in the desert, out in, you know, just the Never Never Land, where most illegal aliens have traditionally crossed. And that's where the Border Patrol has their jurisdiction. That's where they patrol. So when the Border Patrol numbers drop, they're like, oh, where are they all going? Well, they're all going to the ports of entry because President Biden's asylum rule said, generally speaking, you are going to be ineligible for asylum unless you present yourself at a port of entry. And so everyone now is funneling to the ports of entry. And some of you might have seen the news over the weekend. I mean, the video, the footage was stunning. DPS, Texas, you know, state, you know, troopers were holding the line, keeping everyone back from crossing legally, and they were helping funnel people to those ports of entry. The people who wanted to claim asylum already knew they had to go to the ports of entry. And guess what? So the ports of entry are manned by a different set of officers. So when illegal aliens cross there, it goes in a different column in the stats line. So they say, oh, yeah, Border Patrol numbers are down. Yeah, but those numbers are being counted somewhere else. And they won't give us those numbers. We know they have them. So we need to do some detective work, hopefully get some, you know, really smart people in the media like you and, you know, some other reporters out there asking for those numbers because they're there. We just don't have that information yet.
See, and this is what drives me nuts. When people are consciously trying to manipulate the numbers because they want the optics to look good. Same as last week, we had a report that said that U.S. Border Patrol was coordinating with their counterparts on the other side, the on the ground counterparts, so not the higher ups, through a thing called WhatsApp. You know, this app on phones. I've had it on my phone for, there are a lot of people who use it in other parts of the world, not so much in the United States. And they said, well, how did that work? And they said, well, they'd say, we got the last 300 you sent over. We've processed them. Go ahead and send the next bunch, but don't send them all at once because that'll look bad. because TV news will take pictures of thousands of people like they did under the bridge, and that won't look good. So send them over, and we'll tell you. I compared it to boarding an airplane. You're in group one. Now we're done boarding group one. Now comes board. You know, and this is what they were doing. And I don't think our Border Patrol has any choice but to answer its higher-ups, say, okay, you want us to stage them over so it doesn't look bad on TV? And they've been doing that. But when the higher-ups are ordering that, I think they're showing consciousness that they know what they're doing is wrong, and they're trying to hide it.
Oh, yeah. And some of these transfers you were talking about, we had some of our staff were down on the border, and we've had a whole bunch of great people who've sent us video footage down there. They're coordinating with local Mexican officials, and they're opening up the areas and the gates, way far away from the ports of entry, where you don't get all the crowding, and you don't get all the media, and they're just quietly, they're basically organizing to let illegal aliens into the United States. I mean, it is aiding and abetting if I've ever seen it, and I actually have seen the footage. It's unbelievable that our government officials could actually orchestrate this.
Well,
it's mind-blowing.
Especially, Julie, because I'm not a lawyer or anything, but I know the federal law says that aiding and abetting illegal entry to America. Now, conventionally, you'd think of that as, you drive to Mexico, you get somebody to hide in the trunk of your car, and you drive across and you just smile, say, we're just happy family went to Tijuana for the day, and now we're driving back, and you've got this guy in the trunk of your car, you're aiding and abetting. That's aiding and abetting. What these U.S. government officials are doing is that on a massive scale in aiding and abetting. They're breaking federal laws that they took an oath to faithfully execute, aren't they?
Well, it sure looks like it. It sure looks like it from everything we've seen. They'll argue, these people are sympathetic cases, and they were all going to claim asylum anyway, so we're going to get them to the front of the line, in the middle of the night when no one else can see this transfer, right? But, that's what they'll say. But that's really what they're doing. They're having these NGOs, nonprofits. They're all funded by,
Soros and the like.
Oh, yeah, open borders groups.
Julie, let me ask you one thing.
Pick out people.
While we got a moment, I know that TV news loves to shoot the cute little kids all washed and dressed and, dressed nicely with mom, trudging across the border. But the videos I've seen over this past weekend was thousands and thousands of fighting age males. No women, no children, or very few.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole different picture. And yet that's what's coming across, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. And I've actually talked to Border Patrol agents who have had men with gray hair claim to be minors. And they're sitting there trying to, really trying to follow the law. They're actually trying to use dental records to prove that these people are over 18. It is amazing what, the good guys, what they try to do. But yeah, this is what's going on. And of course, they leave all, you've seen it on TV, they leave all their documents. They don't want anyone to prove them wrong. They leave them all on the ravine, the Rio Grande.
They throw it all away.
They leave everything behind. And, and then they come over and they lie.
You know, Julie, I've got a keepsake at one of the events, Feet to the Fire. A gentleman who does a lot on the border, he said, look at this. And he gave it to me. And what was it? A Cuban banknote, basically a Cuban dollar. And I said, what's this? He said, they throw this away. They don't want anything on their person that suggests they might not be from one of the sympathetic countries. That's Julie Kirshner, Executive Director at FAIR. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and this segment is brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. Make sure your loved ones are safe when the power goes out. Call 541-ONA-GEN. That's 541-ONA-GEN. Our Twitter poll today is spending more and more money on the homeless only making the problem worse. I would argue it is making it worse, but I've given you two other options on that question. Because I'd make this case for prior to the last two or three years, Seattle has spent about $250 million every year on the so-called homeless problem, and it got worse. Portland had been spending about $100 million between Portland and Multnomah County, and it got worse. And then in the last couple of years, Multnomah County has passed a brand new tax on citizens to bring in $200 million a year. And guess what happened? The number of the so-called unsheltered houseless has increased by 21% in the last year. I would argue, without being a demographer or a sociologist, the more money they spend so-called providing services to the homeless, the more homeless you get. So you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to the phones now. And if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, we had 350 Christians come to protest House Bill 2002. And give God the glory on that from all over the valley and the state, because Rob Wagner need to be shaken up. Number two, Mayorkas, Rep. The Homeland Security, he is basically committing and using these nonprofits or NGOs. This is no different than them bootlegging. We used to throw them in jail or prison for that, didn't we? In the 20s and 30s under Roosevelt?
Sure did.
This is out and out enablement. You're wondering why they went from $30 million 30 years ago taking care of the homeless to almost $1 billion, raised the property taxes in Multnomah County up about an extra $400 a year, and wondering why people moving out of Portland, being watching criminality be enabled. This is all out the gates of Hades, my friend. This is all out the road of serfdom. This is all out the road of enlightenment. And the last thing I want to address is that American that was on the subway train. You know, what we're seeing, go back to the subway shooter 2021, the black gentleman that shot there, they don't talk much about, who hurt and injured a lot of people, but they'll talk about Uvalde and everything else. They want to use race, my friend, for everything. Yep. So the poverty pimps and the Maxine Waters, the Alvin Braggs, or even the Bowsers in New York, or the new idiot that they got in Chicago, or even the president at Howard University. They all are shameful Americans. They're dishonorable. Imagine this, Ron.
Who's this going to hurt the worst? When you get, and assume that we're not talking about the terrorists who are coming across, and we assume that we're not talking about the people who are being trafficked coming across, but assume that these people are simply coming across. Some of them will just get jobs. They'll make a whole bunch more money than they would have back in either Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, or the like. They'll make, in some cases, 20 times as much money. So you can understand their desire to be here. If they come in and they are offering to be workers, who's going to get hurt the worst in America? I think it's going to be black and brown Americans for the most part. Would you agree?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. It will hurt them. And what I'm seeing in Salem, Eugene, you're starting, even in Woodburn, small communities, you're starting to see the infiltration of MS-13 from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. And it's, they went and beat up on the kid at the cue ball on State Street. The man's a good Marine. Been there 60 years. Serving the community, everything else. Beat up these Hispanic kids, the American raised Hispanic kids from the area, and took their earrings and shoes off, Lars. Now, when you got this much lawlessness, and you, what's going to happen, just like what happened on that subway, except in 1986 when Mayor Dinkins was running, that was the first black mayor, same thing happened. It was Bernard Getz that had to play the Death Wish Moaners, and it's going to push
And by the
to
way,
point.
The jury acquitted Bernie Getz of everything except illegally carrying a gun. And there you go. Let's go to Richard, who's listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Richard, we're close to the break. What's on your mind?
Richard in the Dallas, Lars.
Okay, what's on your mind?
Anyway, I think I recall provisions when these ball stadiums were built, these large football stadiums and all, that if need be, in times of need, they could be used for housing. They could be used for shelter areas.
How does that solve the problem, since the number who came in just last week would fill one of the largest football stadiums in America in a week? And what do you do with them then?
I think, Yeah, I think it would upset the people, so these sports freaks, that they might take notice and do something. Put them in to fill up the football fields. I don't watch football. I don't spend a dime on football.
Well, it might actually get people's attention. I'm not sure it actually solves the problem, because at the end of 1 week, when you filled an entire football stadium and they go to court and say, you must house these people, you must feed these people, you have to provide them medical care, and if you don't, you have to let them go. All you've done is taken them to big blue cities for the most part and facilitated their transportation. You've got the Lars Larson Show.